It is November 25th, and this interview is taking place at the Hotel Fort Garry in Winnipeg, and I'll have our narrator for today introduce herself and her connection to the grain trade.
Hi, my name is Linda Malcolmson, and I've just recently retired from the Canadian International Grains Institute, which is located in Winnipeg. And I was involved in the grain industry through SIGI for the last 15 years.
Just the last 15 years. Mm-hmm. Okay, so normally I like to start these interviews by talking about your very first connection with the grain industry. Were you a child of the farm?
My grandfather was a professor at the University of Manitoba in plant science and was also the department head. And so he had maintained a farm in Carmen, which he used as a summer home. And we spent all of our childhood summer days at the farm. And so I had a very early interest in agriculture.
So your dad was a plant scientist. Did he specialize in any particular?
Yeah, my grandfather was specialized in barley, and so he was instrumental in setting up the Barley Malting Technical Center.
Well, So did you take an interest in your family's history that you could tell us a little bit about? What you remember them talking about related to the industry, especially the barley?
Well, certainly I remember discussing with my grandfather how proud he was of the Canadian grain industry and how we had maintained quality in our grain and therefore were getting good value when we exported the grain to overseas markets. And that always kind of intrigued me that Canada was known for the quality of their grain, and that was, of course, many, many years ago, and something we've been able to maintain.
Did you actually take part in any of the seeding of the crops or harvesting the crops?
On a peripheral, I would have, of course, ridden the tractor and played in the grain as it's being delivered to the silo, but I wasn't really a farmhand, so to speak.
And you were far beyond the stooking of grain, so you didn't have to do the hard physical labor.
None of that, just more of the fun.
Yeah. Can you think of how that grain felt or smelled or any memories of that sort of come back? Or more than just an intellectual connection to the...
Well, I think, I can often think of the smell of that grain, and certainly the smell of the grain after it had been stored in a bin. So certainly all of those elements, and even the itchiness of the grain.
Yeah, I find that a surprising number of people have allergies to, and, in Thunder Bay where, he had grain dust all over the place that... Mm-hmm. It really isn't necessarily benign for a lot of people.
No, certainly a lot of people suffered as a result of being exposed to the grain dust.
So your grandfather was involved in setting up
the Canadian Malting Barley Technical Center.
And where's that?
It's here in Winnipeg, and its role is to essentially monitor the varieties that are going into malting. So at one time they actually had a laboratory where they did the testing. They don't do that work anymore, but they are certainly instrumental in maintaining that malting quality of barley.
Was it a standalone institution or was it associated with any larger group?
No, it's a standalone organization.
Well, I should get a contact.
Yeah.
Maybe somebody who's retired might be able to give us a bit more detail on that.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
And your dad then became...
My dad was also involved in agriculture. He worked for the agrochemical company. So he worked for DuPont. And so he also, I mean, I would be influenced by him because I can recall one time when there was an outbreak of a particular pest in one of the grains, and my father was had to make a decision about, you know, making sure that this chemical was available to counter this pest. And he, it was a very stressful time for him, but it fortunately worked out and the crop was saved. So it was a pretty, one of those situations that was, this pest had come in and it was sort of new and they weren't sure if this chemical would work, but it all worked out in the end. So,
did you pay much attention to your dad's work? I know I didn't.
Yeah. Not, I wouldn't, you know, as a kid, you sort of know about it a little bit, but you don't, I don't think you're that involved.
Mm-hmm. Did he ever say what he liked about his job, what he didn't like about his job?
I think one of the things he didn't like about the job was that people were always saying that these chemicals weren't safe. And, you know, he was always trying to educate people that they had been, they had undergone lots of testing and they were safe if they were used properly. And I guess that was the big issue, were people using the chemicals under the right situations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was he, did he stay in that career for his entire life?
Yeah, he did. He worked for, he only actually worked for two companies, and his latter part was with DuPont.
Okay. Just paused a little bit to check out the volume. Could I just have you say another couple of words? And
certainly, I can say a few more words for you.
Okay. So we met way back in university days.
Mm-hmm.
Did any of your early childhood have an impact on what you eventually chose to?
Well, I made the decision when I went to college to go into home ec, but my uncle was a professor in ag engineering. So you see, agriculture was all around it, although I didn't choose to go into agriculture. But I recall having a discussion with my uncle who said, why don't you go into food science? Because that's, people always need to eat and you're guaranteed to have a career. And it turned out that I did have a strong interest in food and understanding the science of food. And so that's what I ended up studying. And from there I ended up doing graduate work and did all of my research on grain. Particularly with wheat, canola, and also pulses. And then shortly after that, Dude or SIGI here in Winnipeg, and I saw this as a great opportunity to combine that food science with the grain industry and agriculture, and it turned out to be the right choice for me.
When you started out in home economics, because it's a fairly broad area of study, with the food and nutrition being a major part of it. Did you have any preconceived notions that were either born out or did you know what you wanted to do? A lot of people go into university and think they're, you know, they're going to take one course and then over time things sort of shift for them.
I think when I first entered, I wasn't really sure what I would specialize in, but as I mentioned already, that, you know, my uncle did have that influence on me, as also did one of my professors who taught in the foods area and the nutrition area, and I knew where I wanted to go.
How would you describe the difference between the course of studies in home economics versus the course of studies in food science?
Well, I think in those days the differences were that in the home economics area there was more about the individual in terms of nutrition and the food, Whereas in food science, it was more about the processing. And so really for me, getting education in both areas really helped me.
Tell me a little bit about, well, tell me a whole lot about your studies and what you found out about the grain industry, the grain products, as you sort of dug deeper.
Yeah. Well, my area of study for my PhD was on durum wheat, and there I was looking at the effect of both varieties and environment on end quality, like common wheat, in terms of how that affected the quality of end products being made from it. So in that case, it was focused on spaghetti in particular. And from that, that just opened up that whole area for me of the role of breeding and environment of growing plants and how that influenced end quality. And that was something that, that I basically have continued throughout the rest of my career.
Now, did you finish your PhD here or did you go?
No, I did my PhD actually here in Winnipeg, so University of Manitoba. But all my research was done at the Grain Research Lab, which is part of the Canadian Grain Commission. So right when I started my PhD research, I was really much more involved in the grain industry. And that was when I, that was really how the connection got made, I think.
Tell me about the Grain Research Lab.
So the Grain Research Lab at that time was doing a lot of influence by the grading standards. So, for example, if a grain was degraded because of frost damage, how did that affect end quality? And so I found, you know, that was a very rewarding time for me because although I was conducting my own research, it was, of course, by being right in their facilities and interacting with their scientists and technicians, I was learning a great deal about how grading factors influence quality and how Canada would find solutions to the end user of that grain to make sure that they got the best possible quality of the end product.
What sticks in your mind about your work at the...
number of the scientists that worked there. They had a tremendous influence on me, not only as mentors and teachers, I guess, but also their commitment to the Canadian grain industry. They worked very hard on their research, but they also traveled on behalf of the grain industry to conduct... seminars in customer countries and to talk about the quality of Canadian grain. So I really saw how the Canadian industry worked together to sell the product.
Was there official connection between the producers and the research lab?
I think certainly the scientists also attended producer meetings, but I would say that that wasn't their major focus. I know certainly now that that is getting much better.
My understanding in talking to some people who were familiar with their grain research lab, that the scientists there were actually world renowned. Is that your impression too?
Yeah, definitely, because when I was selecting where I would do my PhD, I actually decided that that was the best place for me to go because I wanted to study in the grains area and I really didn't need to leave Winnipeg, but I did need to go downtown to the Grain Research Lab. Yeah, they were, I mean, a lot of them have, those scientists have now retired, and I mean, there's some very good scientists there since they've, you know, replacement, but certainly at that time, which was the late 80s, unbelievably top-notch mm-hmm. scientists.
Were there some that stand out in your mind as
Yeah, there was certainly Dr. Matsuo, who was Durham Wheat son, James Dexter, and Dr. Ken Preston were also very, very highly regarded.
Were they from around the world, or were they mostly Canadian?
They were all Canadian scientists, trained in Canada as well. There was also Dr. James Dawn. He was in oilseeds. He was also very well known.
Yeah. Interesting when you're talking about that time period and the fact that the scientists there were Canadian, trained, if not Canadian, yeah, born. Because in talking to some of the older folks, of course, the Green Research Lab was populated by, in many instances, I guess, people from Britain, mm-hmm, where the...
Yeah, Dr. Keith Tipples was the director when I was there, and he was originally from Britain. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But a real changeover in being able to have homegrown,
yes,
people. Would most of those have been trained in at Prairie?
Prominently. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily University of Manitoba, I know. And that would make sense because only really the Prairie provinces would have a cereal chemistry program.
Was there any connection, official or otherwise, with Eastern Canada? Or was it pretty much Western-based because of the...
I would have to say it was probably more Western-based, yeah.
When you went there, did you take a position, or were you, since you were doing your research, you just sort of went in and used their facilities and...
Yeah, no, I was a graduate student, so I did not hold a position. Mm. But they were very open to having graduate students working in their facilities, and, you know, it was a tremendous opportunity for someone like myself to be there. Very different environment than being at the university, but in its other ways not, because it was a research lab. Exposed to really what was happening on the front line. Like when you're in an academic environment, you don't necessarily have that interaction with, I mean, there was always visitors in the lab from various countries, whether they were other scientists or potentially customers or people from a large mill or bakeries or what have you, mm-hmm, from around the world. And so those were opportunities for me to see that happening. Or also I would hear about what was going on in the grain industry, if there was an issue that year, and how is Canada going to deal with it, and that kind of thing. And also just, you know, things changed over that period of time where certain countries became more prominent in terms of where they were buying or where they were selling to. So, for example, when I first arrived at the lab, that was the change of Russia was no longer the number one buyer of Canadian wheat, and it was shifting to that evolution had happened.
So you had mentioned that your main area of research was in the Durham,
yeah,
and spaghetti in particular, to my little Perozo-adopted ethnic heart.
Yes.
So did you have any connection then when you were doing your research with the major Durham buyers, which would have been...
Well, a lot of it goes to Italy.
Yeah.
In those days. Not so much during that period. It wasn't until I, you know, started working at the Canadian International Grains Institute that I had much more direct involvement with customers.
Mm. So, describe a typical day, if you can, in the life of a PhD student researching.
Well, it's probably very similar to any other graduate student. In any lab, I mean, you start your day with running experiments and again. But I think one of the things that was maybe a little different was I used to have coffee with all the scientists every day. And in those days, you could actually use a Bunsen burner in the lab and make coffee. And of course, this doesn't happen anymore. But...
Did you did your view of the Canadian grain industry expand over that time? Like, what did you learn about the broader industry just because of...
Well, you know, I think where it really broadened was when I started working at SIGI, because that's when I had the opportunity to, as I said earlier, to meet with customers and to get to know some of the other industry players and better understand their role.
Well, let's go on to that later, but what was the outcome of your, what were you hoping to find, or your hypothesis?
Well,
and what were the results?
Yeah, I mean, what we found in that work was, you know, that certainly depending on variety, depending on environment, depending on protein levels, this had a tremendous influence on the quality of, or the end product quality of spaghetti. We also looked, I also included some processing variables, and how that might affect. So in other words, if you started off with maybe poor quality wheat, durum wheat, is it possible to achieve good quality just through manipulation of drying temperatures or processing conditions? And I was able to show that, yes, in fact, you could influence it. So it's not all about the end, or it's not all about the quality of the grain necessarily, but certainly that helps.
Yeah. And what about the blending?
It's good quality, but you could tweak that with processing and achieve better quality.
Do you make your own spaghetti?
I do not.
Have you ever?
Yeah, I have. I certainly have. And even since the days of making it in the lab, yeah.
Yeah. From what you learned about, we'll stick with spaghetti, but other pastas...
Yeah.
How does that translate into what the customer buys? Like, when you go to purchase spaghetti, since you aren't making your own, what do you watch for? And
sure. Well, one of the things I definitely watch for is making sure that it is made with 100% durum wheat. If it says it's made with Canadian durum wheat, that's all so much the better, and that's not just because I'm nationalistic. And I also know a little bit about some of the processors, so I know which ones are using some of that more advanced processing, so I know that even if I cook the spaghetti improperly, I'll probably end up with a good quality.
And you have your favorites, not that I'll necessarily ask you to. You could say which ones, but...
Oh, sure. I mean, I think it's like anything, you know which ones to buy.
Yeah. Well, I can recall someone saying, again, this was a person who was talking about sort of off-the-shelf products, and she was talking about chicken broth, because a lot of people weren't making their own soups because it was such a hassle to make the chicken broth, and was asked the question, well, is there, you know, something out there that you could buy that is a good product, and she was not willing to say which product it was, but she did say it came in a red tin, and it was just a sort of a run of the mix of what she knew about, you know,
yeah,
the quality. So,
yeah.
So can you buy good quality pasta without having to go to a boutique?
Yeah, most definitely. A lot of the industrial made spaghetti is very good. The biggest mistake consumers make is they don't cook it properly.
Well, now's your chance to say to tell us how to not kill the product.
You should follow package instructions, which usually tells you to use a ratio of 10 to 1, you know, water to spaghetti. Most people don't use enough water, and they overcook it.
Yes.
So.
Okay. So. El Dante.
El Dante.
Yes, yes. Well, can't talk to a home economist without throwing in some helpful cooking.
That's right. Yeah.
You mentioned that you're looking for Canadian durum because our durum is a high quality. Now, what creates that high quality in the initial ingredient?
Mm-hmm.
And... why does Canada manage to produce that.
Okay, so the most one of the more critical things is the protein level. And Canada has varieties that lay down quite a bit of protein. It's also the strength of the gluten, again, part of the protein, and also the yellow pigmentation of the durum wheat, so that you know, you're getting a desirable color in that spaghetti or pasta, whatever you're making. So it's really about protein. It's about the color. And I think the other thing too is that we figured out, I mean, we have the right growing environment, and that's why those protein levels are as optimum as they are.
And my understanding from talking to others is there are certain places on the prairies that are better than others. And what creates that? What creates the growing environment that produces the protein?
Well, it's the areas of, it's Saskatchewan in particular, and it's a relatively dry area of production. Okay. So, you know, it's not too wet.
And the wetness would create sort of an imbalance in the, like...
It's a situation of you don't want too much. It's a disease thing as well as getting the dry conditions for protein level.
Hmm. Okay, so what years were you doing your doctorate? What was your master's thesis in?
My master's was in I looked at protein concentrates from faba bean and canola. It was ahead of its time, because it's just now that people are starting to look at fractionating grains to concentrate the proteins or concentrate the starch.
What do you mean by fractionating?
So there's two ways of fractionating. You can fractionate dry, which means that you grind and then you air classify, and it's essentially when you air classify, you're running a stream of air into the flour, and the smaller particles go one way and the larger particles go a different way.
Similar to a sifting process, except using air instead
right.
of grain.
And so what happens is the larger particles tend to be the starch and the smaller particles tend to be protein. Mm. And so nowadays people are looking at, because there's such a demand for vegetable proteins in the world, they're looking at ways to replace, I guess, for example, soybean isolates and concentrates, because lots of people have allergies to that, or to choose not to consume soybeans for whatever reason. So there's more work going on at looking at use of other high protein sources of grains.
Are fava beans grown in any quantity in the Canadian?
No, they're not grown in large quantities. There's a great deal of work, though, actually going on in Saskatchewan in terms of developing varieties, because they're a very high source of protein.
Now, you mentioned canola in the same breath, and I've never thought of canola as being a protein.
But it is, because the byproduct is meal, which is high in protein, once the oil is extracted.
Now, I don't know if I lost track of what you were saying, but you said one way of doing it is with the air fractioning.
Okay, another way is wet classifying. So it's just a matter of distilling out or settling out. So it's the same concept of getting the protein separated from the starch.
But just with water?
Yeah, well, solvents. Yeah.
Solvents. Now, whenever you say thing like solvents, I get a little...
Yes, of course you do. So that's why the dry process is the more preferred way.
What would be the solvents?
Well, a lot of times it's water, but sometimes they have to do some washing to get some... It would be alcohol-based.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, could be worse.
Yes. Well, yeah, they don't do anything worse. But both processes are expensive, right? So that's why you don't see a lot of it being used on everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You mentioned a lot of people being allergic to the soy protein, and therefore looking at others like the canola and the fava bean. And I don't know if you feel qualified to even comment, but we hear a lot these days about gluten intolerance and wheat protein problems. Do you have any comments to make on that? Has there been a change in the breeding of plants that it becomes more of an issue?
No, it has nothing to do with how the new varieties of wheat. I think gluten intolerance has always been there. It's just we're better able to detect people's sensitivities to it, and there is certainly a small percentage of the population that cannot tolerate gluten in their diet, and they should get diagnosed for that and avoid it, because over long term it can have health issues. But certainly, and I can tell you that the food industry is certainly looking at this. There's many more gluten-free alternatives out there for consumers. And they're also taking seriously the fact that it isn't just about making a product to get it on the shelf. They're actually looking at the nutrition of those products. So there's much better alternatives out there. I mean, the early days, for example, of a gluten-free cracker was pretty much starch, and that was it. But now they're looking at making sure there's fiber in there and that there is some minerals. One of the things that people don't realize, if they take wheat out of their diet, wheat flour is enriched, so B vitamins are placed into that flour, and it's a major source of B vitamins for the average individual. So when you start removing wheat flour from your diet, you're also removing a valuable source of minerals and vitamins, and people need to be aware of that and make sure that they're getting those elsewhere in their diet.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people just think it's as simple as just, well, I won't eat it, but they don't realize they're also leaving nutrition on the table.
Mm-hmm. What years were you finishing up your PhD?
It was late, so it had been 80, 89, 90.
90. Yeah. So, what occurred between finishing your PhD and then the last 15 years when you were working in?
Before doing my PhD, I actually was teaching at the University of Manitoba in the Foods and Nutrition Department, and then took a break from that and completed my PhD, and then went back and again was a professor there. And then, as I say, about 15 years ago, I made the change from being a professor at the university to working at SIGI.
Your time as a professor.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was a great
Highlights.
Time. Highlights. Yeah, it was a great opportunity for me. My research there focused on, again, it continued. I always worked on the grains, so I did a lot of work in those days on canola oil. In particular, that was about the time when, canola oil was certainly, had already become the main crop that was being grown. Rapeseed was phased out and canola was, had taken its place. But one of the things that it was criticized for was they felt, given its fatty acid profile, that it wasn't a very stable oil with storage. And so my work focused on looking at the storage stability and the frying stability of canola oil. So very practical research and the sort of thing that customers needed to know if they were going to switch, say, from soybean oil to canola oil or from cottonseed to canola oil in a frying situation, what kind of fry life would they have and what kind of storage stability would they have on their fried product.
Now, what would ordinary consumers think of stability as? What would it would not be a term that would come to their minds for oil isn't stable.
Yeah, I don't know as if the average consumer would know at all what we meant by that. This was more, I think, for processors. I think most consumers don't reuse their oil, so it doesn't really mean the same thing to them. Yeah.
So what are the impacts on a processor using an oil? What happens when it's not stable?
Well, if it's not stable, they're going to have to replenish their oil. For example, in a frying situation, if the oil is breaking down during frying, they're going to have to replenish the oil more often. It's going to be more costly. If the oil that's absorbed by the food, the fried food, isn't stable in packaging situations, then they won't have as long a shelf life. So it has a huge impact on processors.
Is it mainly a question of going rancid, what we'd call going rancid?
Yeah, painty, rancid, that type of thing. So the interesting thing we found in the work was that although the fatty acid profile would suggest it's not a very stable oil, it did actually have fairly good stability. I mean, it's not indefinite or anything like that, but it was much better than you would have thought given the fatty acid profile. So the work showed clearly that it could be used in a frying situation.
A couple of things come up as a result of what you just said or come to my mind. One is you're commenting that rapeseed was replaced by canola, where in speaking to a lot of people in the industry, they just pass it off as being a change in name.
It was much more than a change in name, and that's why there was a change in name to distinguish it. Rapeseed oil was the first oil. The reason actually rapeseed even came into being in terms of growing in Canada was during the war, it was found that Canada did not have an oil seed crop that could supply the Canadian population. And so at that time, certainly we were growing soybeans, but soybeans at that time could only be grown in Ontario, and it was only a fairly small quantity. So if we ever were in a situation where we needed more fat, we had to rely on imports. So research began at looking at rapeseed because it appeared to be a crop that could be grown in Western Canada. The problem with it was, though, it had very high levels of one fatty acid called erucic acid, which is harmful to human health, and also had very high levels of a compound that, if we were feeding the meal, which is left over from taking the oil out of the seed, to animals, was toxic to them, consumed. So great breeding went on to basically replace and lower those levels. And because it was such a marked improvement, that's why the name change.
Over what length of time would it have taken to get from something that was toxic to something that was...
I think it was probably a 15 to 20 year, it usually is the one cycle of varieties, it's 10 to 15 years.
Would that be the kind of thing that genetic modification would be looking at speeding up?
Yes. But, in those days it was all done through traditional breeding practices. And really there was, in the end, there was just a couple of people that worked on that, and yet it's evolved into, it's the Cinderella story.
So who were the people that worked on it?
There was Balder Stephenson at the University of Manitoba, and then Keith Downey, who was with...
What were the origins of rapeseed? Where did it come from?
Europe, I think, was the original. Yeah.
At the time when Canada was discovering that it didn't have an oil seed crop to provide those really concentrated calories. Mm-hmm. What was the major competition for that? We'd have to import, and what would we be using?
Well, we probably imported a lot of probably soybean oil from the U.S. would be my guess.
And why, when you said at the time there was only... soybeans were only grown in Ontario. What was it about Ontario versus the prairies that...
Yeah, well, the original varieties that could be grown were all from the U.S., and the climate's obviously quite different. So the small area in Ontario right along down to Windsor was where soybeans started to be grown. And, of course, those varieties adapted well to that area. And that would have been in the 40s. And then as new varieties came on, Canadian-made varieties, That growing region expanded upwards in Ontario and then started to be grown also in Quebec. And now we have varieties that are short season, which means that they can be grown in more northern parts of Ontario and Quebec, and as well as in Manitoba. I mean, Manitoba has a huge amount of soybeans being grown now. It's basically replaced other crops because of the success they're having with soybeans. And I would say probably 15 years ago, nobody believed soybeans could be grown in Manitoba. So it just shows you how agriculture continues to evolve.
To the same extent as canola has proven, would canola still be the oil seed of choice?
I think yes, because canola, as it turns out, has one of the healthiest nutritional profiles. Some would argue that soybean is also, it is quite a healthy oil, but if you look at the fatty acids, the levels of polyunsaturates and monounsaturates, it still is ahead of soybean, although new varieties of soybean are being released that have improved nutritional quality. So, mm-hmm.
Now, when you say that canola was the Cinderella story, and did you want it to add anything to that beyond what you've already said about happened?
I think it's just quite remarkable that it was the work of so few to develop the variety, the crop canola, millions, billions of dollars. Yeah. So I think it really warrants having a special mention. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We can move on then, I think, to, unless you have anything to add, more to add about those university years.
No, I think that's, I mean, I think I went from canola to pulses in terms of my work, and then, but a lot of that work I was just starting and when I left, and it was something I was able to pick up when I...
And what was the research related to pulses?
Well, at that time, basically Canada started to grow more pulses. So when we talk about pulses, we're saying peas, beans, lentils, and chickpeas. We didn't know very much about quality standards for pulses. Beans, navy beans were certainly used domestically as well as in international markets for canned pork and beans. So we knew something about the quality that's needed for those type of beans. But for any other beans or chickpeas or lentils, we didn't know very much about what our international customers were looking for. And certainly we've grown peas for many years in Canada. I mean, that's actually, that work probably, I mean, peas began being grown with a fair amount of emphasis in Manitoba anyway, in probably the 30s. But again, it was pretty much just cleaning whole seeds and splitting and selling them offshore. And so when I came to SIGI, we saw that was an opportunity of the type of work we could be doing, which was better understanding what customers were looking for and working with breed varieties that met consumers' needs.
Who were the major exporting countries then of those products, or were countries that use them pretty much just supplying their domestic markets?
Well, we, I mean, depending on which crop type we're talking about, I mean, certainly a lot of our colored beans were being exported to Central America, South America, and Mexico. Obviously, things like lentils were going into India, so we're peas also into India. Peas are also widely exported now into China. So again, you know, as Canada got established as being a producer, number one, and then second, a producer of good quality, new markets open up and demand, making us successful or unsuccessful. And so that was sort of some of the early work that had to be done.
What precipitated the change to from the university setting to the Canadian International Grains Institute?
Well, I think I was ready for a new challenge, and I saw that the job was somewhat related. I would continue to do research. I would continue to do education. It's just that I wouldn't be educating university students. I'd be educating customers about Canadian product.
What was the position that you moved into?
So I was director of special crops, oil seeds, and pulses. And for a short time, I also headed up the wheat technology area as well. But then we realized that the whole area of special crops and oil seeds was a big enough job in itself. I didn't need to do the wheat technology.
Review for me what special crops...
So special crops were things like flax, buckwheat, food barley, food grade soybeans. So it was all the sort of minor crops. Not that barley is a minor crop, but food barley is minor. Malting barley is a separate thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Were you in charge of a department?
Yes. So I, during my time there, I was able to convince, I partnered to with producer groups, as well as I wrote proposals to get funding to put in a pulse facility. So we put in a dehuller and a splitter and some flour mills to produce flour. And I was then able to hire some staff that worked on that. And then as the work progressed, because there was greater opportunity there. And so I was able to then work with the other technical staff on things in our bakery and our pasta plant and what have you. So we would take that pulse flour and add it into as a percentage of certain end products and see what the effect was on nutrition as well as on quality and marketability for that.
You mentioned that the focus focused on was it pulses?
I had really three main areas and major areas. I mean, I dealt with many crops, but I focused primarily on pulses, food barley, and food grade soybeans.
And you mentioned at the same time that the reason for the focusing was the fact that there was more potential for market. So tell me about how Canada identifies these things.
I think where my strength came was the fact that I had an understanding of nutrition, I had an understanding of end product quality. And so whenever you're trying to take a crop from being just a basic commodity to a food ingredient, you have to have a good understanding of those other aspects like nutrition and end product quality. So for all of those things, whether it was pulse flours or food barley or the food grade soybeans, which when I say that, I'm talking about tofu, miso, soy milk. There are very unique characteristics that are needed. The customer who's buying those ingredients has a very specific outcome that they're after. They want the tofu to be smooth and not beany tasting or whatever. So that means certain varieties need to be selected to go into that market for a certain nutrition. And so it's a very specialized, and you can see where it's very ingredient specific. It's not commodity based. You know, you're not just trying to, you know, get some peas in and feed them.
Yeah. So I'm, for this project, particularly interested in almost the nitty-gritty of how these things were done and accomplished, because 50 years from now, nobody
will understand how that happened.
So let's say that would you be sitting down at a director's meeting and saying, okay, well, what are our opportunities? What do we see here? Were you connected with, you said, I think briefly mentioned, working with the producer groups. So is it possible to just take one of those, soy as an example, and just work us through how you would get from, actually having something on the other end that meets those user, the customer opens the package of tofu and says, "Whoa, this is good." So, can you run us through that?
Well, I think if we do take, say, soybeans for example, what would have happened there is I would have been working with a producer group who was interested in working with the exporters. So a partnership, basically, between the exporters of the soybeans, the producers who are growing the crop, SIGI, who has expertise in running programs and doing research. And so we would...
So if we use the actual situation that you would work with, who are samples of the exporters? What's the existing producer groups? Can you be that specific?
Yeah, I can be that specific. So in the case of the producer group, it would have been primarily the Ontario soybean growers, which is now Grain Farmers of Ontario. They're still the largest producer of soybeans. During my time working with that organization, the Manitoba and Quebec group joined with Ontario to produce or to form an alliance called the Canadian Soybean Council. And so I would work with them representing the producers who were interested in assisting exporters with their marketing efforts, with the idea being that if customers appreciated what Canada had to offer, Canada would be their first choice in terms of buying. In terms of exporters, there is an organization called the approximately 15 to 20 exporters. So for example, ProGrain in Quebec is one, and Thompson's Limited in Ontario is another example of an exporting company, and they belong to this association, and they would also, come together where they can to do marketing. Obviously, they have their own business, but they would see the benefit of doing generic programming in customer countries. So what I did while I was at SIGI was I worked with both associations to put on programs on their behalf. So I would organize these programs, and when I say that, it could have been an incoming program or it could have been an outgoing program. So incoming would be inviting customers to Canada to showcase the industry, which meant that we would travel to the three soybean growing regions in Canada, show them, take them to a farm, take them to a processing facility, when I mean that, an exporting facility where they would clean, test for the presence of GMO, meet the specifications that a company's looking for. We take them to the port situation to show them how containers are loaded on a ship to ensure quality. We'd visit the Canadian Grain Commission to see what their role was in it. And of course, they would meet with the producer associations and anybody else that, was important to showcase the industry.
How would you identify the
customers?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that would have been a combination of talking with the exporters, because they certainly knew who the customers were. We would also work with the international, the Canadian government, so the various posts in countries, we would talk to them about how best to identify, you know, key customers. And certainly over the years, we did lots of programs for Japan because they were the number one customer of food-grade Canadian soybeans. And so they have, Canada is their leading supplier of soybeans, and so we got to know the post very well in terms of helping us. So it really is any of this, and I think that's Canada's strengths. When we market, it is really a combined effort of everyone working together.
Now, when in this process would you be actually identifying the quality of their end-use product? So would you go and buy some product off the Japanese shelves, or so that, because you said there's also a sort of a product testing component to this so that you can...
Yeah. So we would also do outgoing programs, and so those would be to go and deliver a seminar to customers. So we'd have we'd hold a seminar at a hotel and invite the customers to come. But we would also organize visits to specific industry, specific country companies, and there we would have very good discussion about end product quality, and of course we would have the opportunity to try products. Again, taking that information back and working with the breeders here in Canada, and sometimes they accompanied us. We would ask them to join us on those outgoing missions, and ultimately, I think that really is critical, because if the breeder doesn't understand, you know, that end quality is critical, and this is the things that they're looking for, the varieties aren't going to be developed the same way.
Was there always a solution?
No, not always a solution. Because
were there some things that no matter what you did, you really couldn't meet?
Well, sure, because
the product just couldn't be produced with Canadian.
No, I mean, I think usually when we went, we could usually find a solution for them to use Canadian product. The thing is that some of the things that customers ask for, there isn't a short, you can't get an answer to it right away. So for example, if beaniness is a flavor they don't want, it does take time to develop a variety that doesn't have that flavor profile. I mean, you can't do that in a year.
What is beaniness?
Well, a lot of, for example, soybeans have a very strong bean taste. It tastes like a very strong soybean. So they want a milder tasting product. But we couldn't always, you know, guarantee them that we had a variety that was there, but it didn't mean that down the road we wouldn't. And it depended really on whether, first of all, it was possible from a science point of view, and second of all, if that was a really strong desire by a large number of processors.
Then it was worth doing the research, as you mentioned before.
Yeah.
What kind of connection then was there back to the Grain Research Lab?
Well, depending on what the crop was, again, in the area of food-grade soybeans, there wasn't really one because they weren't active in that area. But certainly, you know, they had in the areas of durum wheat and oil seeds, you know, whether it was canola or flax, that's where those type of connections could be made, where you'd talk to them in terms of, again, they would participate in those missions, or and they would hear that information firsthand as well. So it really depends on the crop and what the issues are.
Yeah. Was that always a good working relationship? Because I can see in certain circumstances, more not so much circumstances as people, where like, where do we draw the line? Can we always cooperate? Or are you sort of poaching my research? Is that
an issue? You know, I never experienced that. I always felt that the, I mean, I did a lot of collaborative work with the various scientists at the Green Commission where my time permitted it. I think the Green Commission was always a part of SIGGI programs because they're a key part to basically promoting Canadian product. So, and you know, there's always more problems to solve than there are people, so I never saw it as an issue, and I don't think they did either. But as you know, a lot of times it gets down to personalities and cooperation and willingness. So, you know, they can't answer everything because they weren't able to, you know.
Mm-hmm. We're at just about, we're actually at the hour mark, so why don't we take a bit of a break?
Sure.
Okay, we had a nice little break, and now I'd like to continue with where we left off. I think you did a good job of explaining how to take that one product. One thing I'd like to ask is the connections that you would have had in order to identify the potential markets, they would have been exclusively from the producer groups. Whereas if you were looking at wheat, for example, I would imagine there's a really tight connection with the wheat board.
Right. So in the case of wheat, it would have been coming from the Canadian Wheat Board in those days. But with some of the other crops, it wasn't so much producers, because producers didn't necessarily know where their crops were going and where the emphasis. It would be more talking with the exporters. So the companies that were actually selling into those markets, or with talking with the posts in the various countries where they could see opportunities.
I'm going to ask some questions about connections to other groups in the industry, and where you've already commented or said all that you want to say about it, just say, you know, I've already dealt with that. One of the things I found interesting about the industry, since I knew extremely little about it before we started this project, is just how many players they are, and how in the majority of the situations they actually worked in a nice cooperative fashion to help with the Canadian, to improve the Canadian trade in the international markets. I think you've said a fair bit about your connection with the producers. Was there any connection at all in the work that you did with the carriers, either railways or the ships?
The only connection we had with them is if we asked them to provide a lecture in one of our programs, they would come and give a lecture to our participants in a program. And also, I guess, sometimes we would actually have the opportunity to visit a port, so we would have had to have their cooperation in visiting that port.
So, to take that just a little bit further then, grain handling, did that have any impact on the grain handlers? That would include inspectors and so on. Was there...
Well, certainly, if we did a... I mean, what we were doing in a situation like that, we were showing to customers the difficulty we have in Canada in terms of getting our grain to export position. And this is an important piece of information for customers to learn, that it isn't as straightforward as it is in other countries that are producing grain, where the grain is easily moved to port position, and they're also closer to deliver that grain to that customer. I mean, Canada grows, as you know, grows all the grain in the center of Canada, and then we've got to get it east, or we've got to get it west, and we're in the Northern Hemisphere, and a lot of our markets are in the South. So that's why we needed the cooperation of the rails and the shippers in terms of resourcing our program.
Now, would it make any difference to the customer? I mean, wouldn't they just say, well, that's your problem?
Well, I mean, they would, of course, they would say it's our problem, but they at least gained a better appreciation of when we weren't able to deliver as timely as they would like, or the fact that we needed a bigger lead time, or that it was more costly. I mean, ultimately, they had to be aware that it was going to cost money to, mm-hmm. to get the product there, so...
You referred a couple of times to the courses that the people would take. So tell us more about those courses.
So the programs were almost always undertaken on behalf of an association. So we didn't do too many programs just on our own. We always partner with someone to deliver a program. So it could have been the Canadian Wheat Board asking us to do a program for Latin American millers, for example. Or it could have been the Canadian Soybean Council saying, we want you to do a program for tofu manufacturers in Japan. Or it could have been Pulse Canada coming to us and asking us to do a program, or the Canola Council. And it was always to market the Canadian product. And so we would work with that partnering organization to develop a program that was tailor-made to fund the program. The way SIGI operates is that we get a portion of our funding from the Canadian government to do marketing efforts on behalf of the Canadian industry, but in order to access those dollars, we had to have matching dollars from the industry.
Has that changed now with...
Has changed partially, but we are still getting, or SIGI is still getting some federal government money as well as producer money.
Does that come out of the Department of Agriculture budget then, or Trade and Commerce, or a combination?
It comes out of agriculture, yeah.
And what were sort of the standard pieces? You said that the courses were tailored to the specific customer. Requested by the that mostly always found their way into?
One thing that was always common to all the programs, whether they were more technical in nature, so sometimes, for example, we might have had millers that came from various countries to learn about how to mill Canadian wheat, or we might have done something much more generic. But always what was common to all those programs was time spent on a farm. So we felt it was critical that those participants met with a Canadian farmer and understood how crops were grown in Canada. They always spent time with the Canadian Grain Commission as the regulator, better understanding the Canadian system for grading and inspection and any of the other relevant programs. They also spent time in the SIGI facilities, because there was pilot facilities to show them the work that we were doing to better understand the quality of our grain and their applications.
Was there, and this is a self-serving question, was there equipment and testing, like old mills and things like that were no longer needed, that are sort of stored away, stashed away somewhere, waiting for somebody like us to ask? Can we take them off your hands?
Yeah, I think there is going to be some equipment that you can access.
Who else would want it?
Yeah, for sure. Well, one other thing I should also tell you that we did, and it was common to all of them, is that we usually visited a grain handling facility. So we would visit an elevator, whether it was a country elevator or a terminal elevator, or it could have been a small cleaning plant, depending on the commodity.
What kind of reactions did you get? We're particularly interested in the terminal elevators and the large ones. What?
Well, first of all, especially when we visit, the common themes that we would have, whether we visited a Canadian farm or a terminal elevator, it's the size and volume of grain that is moving. Whether, you know, the farms in Canada are large, especially in Western Canada, and then certainly when you visit a terminal elevator, the volume of grain that's moving through it. And we always tried to target our programs to happen, well, ideally in the fall, but they happen throughout, you know, the better climate time in Canada, spring to fall. But if a participant was lucky enough to come on a program in the fall, I mean, that's when there was so much action that they couldn't believe it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Speaking of action, makes me think of developing resources such as films. Did Siggy develop films for use during those?
Siggy actually did develop several films. One of the ones that we used for quite a few, and certainly those are available too.
Yeah, good. I think that probably deals with those, with that interconnectedness. When you think back on your career, and I think particularly your time with Siggy, what changes have you seen?
I think one of the most noticeable changes that I saw over that period of time was the sophistication of the customer. That they became much more knowledgeable about the quality that they needed in their raw material, and also the fact that I could offer. So I watched markets grow for Canadian grains. I mean, the market was always very good for Canadian wheat and barley, but what I saw over that period of time was the market for canola and the market for Canadian pulses grow tremendously.
Where were the increases in the markets? What quadrants of the world, would you say?
Well, for pulses, I would say China became a major growth market for Canadian peas, and they buy huge quantities of yellow peas to extract the starch to make what they call vermicelli noodles, so starch-based noodles. And that was something that they actually figured out for themselves, that peas could be substituted for mung beans, and that's a huge cost saving to them because mung beans are very, very expensive, and they're not grown widely in the world. So that was one area. And then the area of canola oil, I would say that the major growths were...
Were there shrinking markets as well that you noticed? Or not in the areas that you were...
Well, you know what? I think where I would have seen that primarily would have been in the wheat markets, where markets shrunk in certain areas, but then they grew in others. So there continued to be a demand for Canadian wheat, and rightly so, we changed the market emphasis for the people that were willing to pay for that quality.
Rather than competing on the lower quality grain that everyone could grow and wanted to.
Yeah. But, I mean, you always have to maintain possibly some of those markets because there are times when, you know, we do have a problem with quality due to growing conditions.
Mm-hmm. Any changes in the organization itself?
Siggy?
Mm-hmm. Lack of growth.
I think what I saw over that period of time was activities for the Canadian Wheat Board, so primarily wheat and malting barley, and we saw that work continued, but there was additional growth in the areas of the pulses and the canola food barley and the soybean.
So when you were just thinking about retiring. You retired right at a major time of change in the industry itself, and in particular the change in the role of the wheat board. Was it too soon to have any impact on the Canadian International Grains Institute, or was that, can you predict whether it would have any change?
No, I mean, we already knew that, I mean, we were given advanced, well, not advanced warning, but, I mean, it took a year before organization to what was going to happen, and, I mean, we had some lead up even before that it might happen, and so we were looking at how we could position the organization to the change, and as a result of that, I think, the organization has dealt with the change fairly well.
So what would be the major repositionings that had to take place?
Well, in the area of wheat, what we had to do there would be to align with the other exporters, because up until then, we were just dealing with the Canadian Wheat Board, but now we were dealing with all the organizations involved in marketing of wheat. So that just meant, not that it wasn't a case of not having interaction with those other, the grain companies, but we just hadn't been active with them in terms of hosting programs and what have you.
Mm-hmm. Was there any change as a result of the disappearance of the wheat pools?
That was
sort of the rapid.
I think I don't think that one was quite as much of a change as the wheat board's change. The reason being, we at least had been involved with those other, all of the grain industries, whether they were the pool or the whatever company was that bought them out. But they were more as people that participated in our programs by helping us, like we would hold a host a reception and they would come. Well, now we had a few less people at our receptions.
So I'm thinking now of Glencore in particular, because that's the one that had the most major change in ownership.
Mm-hmm.
But did the people who ran that organization, who were kept on, were they people who were familiar with the, with the work of Siggy and so on? So really, it wasn't that you were unfamiliar with the intent of your work.
I think that's one thing that Siggy has done well, is that they are well known to the grain industry, and so you're right, those people were still involved, and Siggy is highly thought of, so that's another positive thing. It was always an interesting organization. We were well known to the grain industry here in Canada, and we were certainly known around the world, but within Canada nobody knew what this organization was. But it's not a large organization either. There's only 35 people, and basically most of our work is done for international markets, and so that's where we should be known.
Mm-hmm.
And of course known domestically with the grain companies.
Challenges. Thinking back to whichever position or all positions that you've had, describe some of your major challenges.
Well, I think that probably the biggest of all organizations, and so sometimes that made for challenge because not everyone agreed on the path towards marketing. So, for example, producers may have had a different view than, say, the exporters or that type of thing. But, that was sort of our strength, was trying to bring the two groups together and decide what could be done together for the benefit of the industry. And so, of course, some days it seemed like, why bother? But ultimately, you had to keep focused on what was the goal, and it was to market Canadian grain for the quality that it has. And if you believe in that, you'll find a way around those challenges.
Now, what would be the difference between the producer versus the exporter? Is that what you said? So what would be...
Well, for example, the ex market, generically, about Canadian grain, what they didn't like was if we exposed their customers to their competitors, right? So, which we could appreciate. We didn't want to interfere with business. So that was where it got a little bit tricky, was to do that, but yet provide that opportunity for them to get on with their business with their specific customer.
So how could you actually...
Well, for example,
balance those.
It wasn't easy, but what we would do is, for example, if it was an outgoing mission, we would host a seminar and then allow time for one-on-ones with the companies and the customers, so that they could arrange to do their business with their particular customer. So, and it was a case of working very closely with them to make sure that how we set up that seminar benefited them to do their business, because ultimately that's what it's all about,
mm-hmm.
making sure that the business takes place.
Which brings up an interesting point, because one of the, we've done interviews of people working closer to the ground, I would call it, in especially in Thunder Bay,
mm-hmm.
and speaking to some of the old-timer managers of the various elevators at a time when the Wheat Board was operating. You had quite a mix of the cooperatives versus the private terminals, and you had the operation of the Ports Clearance Association, which tried to sort of smooth out deliveries so
mm-hmm.
that you could get things moving as quickly as possible. And you also had a player like the Wheat Board and the Grain Commission, I think, maybe to some extent. Term I want to use here, working with the rail companies with some clout. And now we have such a different landscape. And what some of the managers who were sort of in place as the companies were amalgamating and then the disappearance of the Wheat Board, and saying that they used to work in a very cooperative environment.
Mm.
Where you know, somebody's short on a shipment, well, they just call so-and-so, the competing company, and because, you know, we were sort of all in this together. And but they said even in their time, which was far less of a change than now, that sense of cooperation, openness, knowing what was going on.
It's not there anymore.
It's not there anymore, and I would think that would make the work of...
Yeah, and I guess time will tell what will happen there. I mean... right now, it's basically Siggy still has the main mandate to do marketing on behalf of the industry, but it will be more challenging to get the buy-in from the industry, I think, because of the very thing you're saying. It's the competition is much greater, and people are not necessarily as willing to cooperate. And
for the reasons that you're saying about the
yeah.
what you've been dealing with the smaller suppliers, and now you're dealing with the major commodities.
Yeah. So then, you know, and I think it's, why would it be any different for them?
Yeah. So in a sense, Siggy might be well placed because they've already dealt with this, just not with the.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, and a lot of times, I think what happens, and it makes sense when you think about it, is that if a market becomes established. Is there a need for this generic marketing? But, I mean, I think all organizations have to evolve. So, I mean, Siggy will figure out where their role will be.
Or they'll disappear.
Or they'll disappear. God, we hope not. But because I do think they bring value, but not if that value is not needed anymore. So they'll figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, it's, you know, every organization's gone through such change. It makes sense that Siggy too will. Well, and it has gone through some change, but it hasn't been devastated at this point.
It's not.
I think we're pretty much done.
Now I remember what I wanted to say.
Okay.
I'm wondering, too, whether you faced any challenges on the more sort of practical side, which is, was there a particular quality issue that was really difficult to accomplish? We talked before about, you know, making sure that there was no beanie flavor to the soybean. So, you know, something that was a real challenge, and then finally, after all this hard work, you had it.
Well, I think one of the things that we've done a lot of work with pulses, and as I told you earlier, we didn't really understand what quality was in pulses. We didn't really understand what customers were looking for. So that was quite challenging. I decided that we should establish a pulse program at Siggy. So we set up a facility, and we also hired some staff. But then, you know, you couldn't get qualified staff who'd worked in pulses because nobody had worked in pulses. So that was very challenging. But what I saw, actually this fall, I saw my former staff presenting at a scientific conference in the U.S. It's a cereal chemistry conference. And it was really rewarding to see that not only the quality of the work they were presenting, but that other scientists were referring to their work. So I would say that was one of the more challenging things that in the end has really paid off. They've become sort of the experts, well, certainly the Canadian experts.
Now, that's another question I had, because one of the things you mentioned early on in the interview was the fact that when you went to do your doctoral work at the Canadian Research Lab, here you were in amongst these people who were world-renowned for their research and respected. Has Canada held that position, or have they sort of backslid?
Well, as you know, the government has certainly cut back a lot of positions, so we're losing scientists in many organizations, Agriculture Canada being one, the Grain Research Lab, which is part of the Canadian Grain Commission, has downsized as well, people from Canadian Food Inspection Agency, scientists from there as well. So it is a bit of a concern, in my opinion, that we're losing scientists. We're losing, those are government-held positions, but even universities, I mean, it's difficult to maintain programs there. I mean, all of this is costly. And I think the other thing that a lot of organizations are finding is that it's hard to get qualified staff, PhDs in cereal chemistry, to be specific. And so that's all affecting. So I would say, in answer to your question, perhaps we're sliding.
Yeah. Who would be, what other countries would, like at one time, according to some people, like Canada's way up there, with perhaps Britain, and I think Germany might have been mentioned. Are other countries coming to the forefront then, that will be the go-to nations for that research if Canada doesn't do it?
Well, yeah, it's a difficult question to answer because I think a lot of countries are facing the same problem, especially if they're public funded, and we are talking, you know, government researchers or academics. Certainly you'll see the rise of, for example, China, where there may be more scientists being employed, a lot of them trained here in Canada. But the thing is, they aren't going to do the research that benefits the Canadian industry. So in the end, I think it's a loss for Canada.
Will the private sector be able to pick it up?
Well, you know, this is an interesting one, because one of the things that the Canadian government, one of their rationales for downsizing some of the scientists with Agriculture Canada is their belief that the private sector would pick up on the breeding efforts. The truth is, some of them will, but it depends on the crop, and it also may not be as thorough a job in terms of the research, especially when at the same time as we're getting rid of scientists in the public sector and downloading that to the private, we're also changing things from a varietal registration system, which means that it may reach the point where new varieties will be released and they won't undergo the rigor that they once did, which was to maintain a certain level of quality. So, you know, I know that this varietal, the varietal registration is being reviewed right now by all the various crops sectors, and depending on what happens, I can see that it may not be good for the industry, because it could mean the release of just any kind of variety, which then means the customer, it's dependent on them to do their testing. And they may not be as willing to buy from Canada, because Canada always had such rigid restrictions on quality that if they bought Canadian, they pretty much knew what they were getting. Now if we have general release, they'll have to test. Maybe why buy Canadian?
Especially since you said the cost is higher, because we've got these other factors that we have to deal with, such as...
Yeah. And I think maybe it's a case of people not really understanding the quality, what has been Canada's success. And they think, well, maybe it's just, we just need to get the product out there, it doesn't matter.
And is there a likelihood that if it's privately funded, it, unless it's a private coming together, several private groups coming together to share the research, that then it just is proprietary.
Right.
And
then it's everyone's business. Or
yeah.
It's just everyone's out for themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
What would you describe as the major changes and advances in science and technology related to the work that you did over the time?
Well, I think several things come to mind. I mean, I think the clearer understanding of nutrition being important was one. Another one being the knowledge about functional foods, so that's somewhat related to health and nutrition.
Now, functional foods, some people wouldn't understand.
Okay, functional foods is when you have a food that contains health benefits beyond the basic nutrition, so beyond protein and vitamins and minerals. You might have a specific compound that's present that has a huge impact on health. So most people would be aware of things called antioxidants, so that would be an example of a functional benefit beyond basic health. And so really I think a lot of Canadian grain actually falls into the functional food category. Things like flax, which is loaded with more than just you know, high levels of omega-3, but it also contains a lot of other specific components that adds to the health nature of flax.
And where's the research coming for those, out of those, out of universities, out of...
That would be mostly out of universities, yeah.
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 Any disasters?
Well, I mean, other than sometimes a program not going as well as one hoped. But no, I wouldn't say really any disasters.
So what constitutes a project?
Program that doesn't really work out well, that could be that you have perhaps some problems getting your participants to the country, travel. One year we had SARS epidemic, which meant no one wanted to travel to Canada, so we lost a substantial amount of money on travel and hotels, and because we had to cancel everything. So that would have been one, I would say.
That would have been
though that would be a disaster year for us, but those don't happen very often.
What did you, if you could encapsulate in a couple of sentences what you know about the Canadian grain industry now, as you retire, to what you knew when you were out on your grandfather's...
Riding on his tractor?
Riding on his tractor, playing in the grain.
Well, I think one of the things that, in a nutshell, I'm really impressed with how, in the past, they worked in a cooperative fashion for the betterment of the grain industry, and how they had elevated the belief that Canadian grain was of high quality, and therefore it demanded good dollar for the product people were getting. And I just hope that continues, because to me, ultimately, that's where Canada wants to be, or should be, industry as a whole.
Figure the producers understand that?
Not so sure. Because I think a lot of times they don't know the whole picture, right?
Yeah. This is going to be almost a silly question, given what we've talked about up to this point. But what is, and I'm reading right off my questionnaire here, what is your sense of the role that you and your company played in Canada's success as an international grain trader?
Yes. Well, I think our role was, and me specifically, was just facilitating that very thing, doing technical marketing, helping customers understand the Canadian system and the quality and why our product was suitable for their processes. So,
just directly related. No need to use any imagination to connect the dots.
No whatsoever.
Canadians, starting with Thunder Bay, but it is in the middle of the country, and there are people that still travel on the ground from one end of the country, in the fact that Canada does have a grain trade to be proud of.
Mm-hmm.
What would you like to see reflected in, if we ever get a center set up, reflected in the programming or the displays that would celebrate what your what you've done, the type of work that you've done or the work that
Siggy's done. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think I would like to, I think it would be nice if you could showcase a little bit of what Siggy has done, because I think they've helped to build that. They played a role in establishing those international markets in particular, because they were the technical marketers. So they went with these other organizations to talk to customers, you know, more. We found that, or I certainly found this, that when I talked with customers, they were comfortable talking about their technical difficulties or what they liked about Canadian product over a competitor's product, because ultimately I'm not trying to sell them the actual product. And they felt, I mean, it was knowledgeable, obviously, on a technical level as well. So I think Siggy really played a role in building those internet, and still continues at this day. So I think it would be nice if you could feature us as one of the partners in the broad scheme.
And even just seeing where your reach was,
mm-hmm.
because I think that I still can't comprehend. Although one of our little, we had a display at the Thunder Bay waterfront, which was quite an eye-opener for the people from Thunder Bay who've seen these ships going in and out.
Yeah.
We had this one, Where the Grain Goes.
Yeah.
And it was amazing to me, disheartening as well, where you'd have people in the products to various places in the world and speaking to their children and saying, well, that's where the grain comes from.
Yeah.
So they're, you know, just no concept.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I don't know the current statistic for Siggy, but I think it's over 26,000 participants from 35 different countries.
Wow.
Have attended a program at Siggy. So
yeah,
we've certainly brought a lot of people to Winnipeg. You know, most programs would at least start in Winnipeg, and then we took them elsewhere as well.
Mm-hmm.
Or some just stayed in Winnipeg, but it's fairly impressive.
Yeah. And for our part, I mentioned to you about that we were interested in the science of the industry as well. Maybe we can even create some interest so that people will go on into those areas of study.
Yeah, that would be fantastic, and because I think we need them.
Yeah, well, fewer people on the farm, and that's traditionally where they came from.
Yeah.
You being an example.
Yeah, exactly.
Final question then, unless you have other questions. What are you most proud of when you think back on your career? What brings you the most sense of satisfaction?
I think for me it's been the people that I've had the opportunity to either work with or to talk to, on whether it's about research or technical issues or just learning more about their country. For me, the greatest reward has been the people and building research teams or collaborating on research. So it's people.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
It's been enlightening. I love to see how everybody brings their little piece of information to the puzzle that makes it even more complex than it was. You know, it's not just a farmer putting some seeds in the ground.
Exactly. Yeah.
So thanks very much, Linda. Yeah. I appreciate you taking the time.